It was very disheartening and disturbing, although not surprising.
The Supreme Court seems to be considering redefining presidential power. That plus what you need to know from the first week of witnesses at the Trump hush money trial. For Saturday, April 27th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, Senator Bernie Sanders defends the ongoing college campus protests against charges of anti-Semitism.
This is not just college students. The American people are sick and tired of funding a war machine.
We'll also talk to economist Emily Oster about her latest book, which focuses on how to navigate difficult pregnancies and how to better prepare for tough conversations with doctors. And the deep thoughts behind the latest Iron and Wine album.
Are you present or are you distracted by all the sort of nonsense of life? Because this is it.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Education Department's top student loan official is stepping down in June. NPR Sequoia Carrillo reports this comes amid a tenuous admissions cycle for prospective college students.
Richard Cordray will no longer be in charge of the federal student loan program come June. The Education Department announced his departure on Friday, as many students around the country are still waiting for their student loan packages, months behind schedule. Cordray oversaw the bumpy rollout of a revamped federal student aid form this year. Delays and processing errors have been ever present, forcing colleges to move back their acceptance deadlines. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
As aid groups brace for an Israeli ground offensive in southern Gaza, Egypt is scrambling to try to broker a new ceasefire deal. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the renewed diplomacy.
Egypt sent a delegation to Israel Friday to press Israel not to enter Rafah in southern Gaza and instead focus on a ceasefire deal that would see the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Now, a top Hamas official says the group is studying the latest proposal from Israel and will soon respond. The official did not provide details of what's being negotiated. Up to now, talks have centered on a six-week truce with the release of about 40 of the 133 hostages and the release of hundreds of Palestinians from Israeli jails. The U.S. has accused Hamas of holding up the deal. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It was another busy week in court for former President Donald Trump. At his hush money trial in New York, Trump sat at a table as a tabloid publisher told the New York jury about his efforts to pay off people with salacious stories about Trump before the 2016 election. NPR's Kerry Johnson has more.
He described himself as a longtime friend to Trump, but he offered some pretty damaging testimony. He said he knew about or took part in payoffs to people who had stories to sell about Trump's personal behavior before the 2016 election. David Pecker said Trump was not worried about his family finding out, but he was worried about his political standing if stories about his alleged womanizing got published. Trump's lawyers tried to suggest Pecker was acting to benefit his own company, not Trump.
NPR's Kerry Johnson reporting. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court this week debated whether Trump should get a legal shield for his actions around the deadly January 6th Capitol riot that happened 3 years ago. The National Weather Service has issued tornado watches from Texas to Iowa today, warning of the possibility of strong storms, large hail, and straight-line winds. Flooding is also a possibility. Yesterday, several tornadoes hit the same area, blowing away buildings from their foundations in Omaha. Storms are expected to continue in the area tomorrow. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is WBUR. I'm Solon Kelleher in Boston. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu says she helped make the call to clear a pro-Palestinian encampment at Emerson College earlier this week. She said in a statement that she and Police Commissioner Michael Cox made the decision together because of public safety and fire hazards. Police arrested 118 people Thursday night. Videos of the arrest prompted criticism of how some police officers handled the overnight raid. Meanwhile, the president of MIT is calling for an end to the encampment on its campus. President Sally Kornbluth made an address today in which she said the university would not cut research ties to Israel as protesters are demanding. She said the university has not interfered with the demonstration out of respect for students' free expression, but ended her remarks with this.
We are open to further discussion about the means of ending the encampment, but this particular form of expression needs to end soon.
Kornbluth has directed the MIT Police Department to maintain a presence at the encampment 24 hours a day. Boston hosts its 10th annual Citizenship Day today. It's co-hosted by the nonprofit immigrant services organization Project Citizenship. Executive Director Gail Breslow says filling out a U.S. citizenship application can be daunting.
It's complicated. The form has 14 parts to it. If English isn't your native language, going through the application can be very confusing.
Monique Tuwin is Boston's director of the Office of Immigrant Advancement and was once undocumented. She says she lived in fear before becoming a citizen.
Having that weight taken off of me and knowing that I had clear standing in the United States made me feel more secure about my life.
Organizers expect to help more than 400 aspiring citizens today at the Reggie Lewis Center in Roxbury. And the Celtics and Bruins both have playoff games tonight. The Celtics start at 8 and the Bruins, the Celtics start at 6 and the Bruins at 8. Increasing clouds with temperatures dipping into the 40s over the evening and a slight chance of showers early morning. Those clouds will stick around through tomorrow, high of 68 and a chance of showers in the evening with a low of 55. Monday, partly sunny skies. High in the mid-60s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Annie E. Casey Foundation, using research and evidence to develop solutions that help families and communities create a brighter future for young people. More information is available at aecf.org.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow, and we are going to start the show with Trump's trials.
This is a persecution.
He actually just stormed out of the courtroom.
Innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
This week, we heard opening arguments in the former president's New York hush money trial and testimony from three witnesses for the prosecution. Most prominently, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer. He gave us the first look into how the prosecution is framing their case as one based on a pattern of election interference, as they frame it. Perhaps even more consequential, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week over whether Donald Trump or any other president is immune from criminal prosecution. Although the justices seemed unlikely to grant Trump's blanket immunity request, many conservative justices seemed open to the idea of some form of presidential immunity, and it looks like there's a likely chance that any ruling would delay Trump's federal election interference case even further. I discussed both of these cases with NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, as well as University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley. I started by asking Kim what she made of the story the prosecution is trying to tell the jury in the hush money trial.
Well, there are really three legs to the stool here that they have to prove. The first is this is essentially a crime of falsification of business records. That's really the big issue here, which is not that big. But to get it from a misdemeanor to a felony, they have to prove that Donald Trump had an intent to commit fraud relating to those documents and that the intention was to cover up the hush money payments to affect the 2016 election. So I think their story was, using David Pecker, listen, Donald Trump knew about this scheme and he knew that it was about making sure that this information didn't go public to impact the election. So using his former secretary to put Stormy Daniels in Trump Tower, to her testimony that he kept Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal's names and contact information in his Rolodex, so to speak, that loops her into Donald Trump's orbit to establish that he was well aware of all this. Mm-hmm. And then Pecker did testify that, you know, the understanding was this was about killing stories because they were really worried about, in particular, the excess Hollywood tapes impact and having that just be exacerbated by additional extramarital affairs.
Right, because Domenico, that is a key thing here. David Pecker, the former National Enquirer CEO, is detailing this system where the magazine pays for lurid stories, gives people money for exclusive rights with the intention of never publishing them, of buying them and burying them. Pecker is saying that he's doing this to help Donald Trump. That in itself, in a vacuum, is kind of seedy but not illegal, right? So the part the trial is focused on is what happens next, and Pecker testifying that he wasn't doing this because he liked Donald Trump, he wasn't doing this because he was embarrassed for Donald Trump, he was doing this because he wanted to help Donald Trump win, which makes it effectively a campaign contribution.
Yeah, I mean, and beyond, you know, whether or not this is illegal, you know, whether it's normal, no. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that presidential candidates do. I mean, presidential candidates are not traditionally coordinating with the National Enquirer to kill stories about alleged affairs and creating stories about how your main opponent at the time, Ted Cruz, was, you know, his father was part of a conspiracy to kill JFK. And that was completely made up.
Yeah. And yeah. We should just remind people, it did kind of take over the campaign for a couple of weeks at a point where Cruz was Trump's main remaining opponent.
Right. And people were analyzing the photo and, you know, and you can just imagine sort of Pecker and Trump kind of like laughing about this kind of greatest troll ever, you know, created, because, again, it was completely made up. It was intended, according to Pecker, to, you know, help Trump in the election, which seems fairly obvious considering Cruz was the, you know, last man standing in the Republican primary. You know, and that's why prosecutors allege that this is election interference. It started in the primary. It didn't just end up with, you know, Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels as these hush money payments to allegedly cover up affairs, but was happening throughout this whole thing and was essentially created, prosecutors are trying to show, to be able to help Trump win.
Kim, the defense gave its opening argument. It cross-examined Pecker at length. The defense has cross-examined some of these other witnesses as well. But what to you is clear about the defense strategy based on what you've seen so far?
I think the strongest strategy, the strongest defense, is that this is just what happens in the rough and tumble of politics. His lawyer said, you know, it's called democracy. I think that's a almost grotesque exaggeration. Even if the government proves that Donald Trump was part of this, which it seems like Pecker established that, and that it was about keeping information quiet around the campaign, that's not illegal, or at least it shouldn't be treated as a crime for purposes of this candidate, or for, you know, the candidate for 2024, that this is just what happens.
There's been a series of hearings about the gag order that the judge put in place on Trump, and the prosecution saying that Trump is repeatedly violating it through social media posts, through statements in the hallway, and we're waiting for a ruling. But Kim, there was a big hearing on this, and there hasn't been a ruling.
There hasn't been a ruling, and, you know, Donald Trump seems to have pivoted his speech to how unconstitutional, unfair, and unprecedented this gag order is. I mean, as with Donald Trump, the reason we're in this position has nothing to do with the courts. It's about him, and getting him in line. I mean, the judge said to his lawyer, Todd Blanche, you're losing credibility, counsel, by sort of claiming that this is all okay. I'm paraphrasing. The judge, I think, is frustrated. And there's a concern that Donald Trump just doesn't care, and he will continue to escalate violations of the gag order, which is narrow. He can say things about the judge. He can't say things about witnesses. He can't think things about jurors. And there's two pieces here. One has to do with protecting the integrity of the trial, making sure that his constitutional rights are complied with. And the other is safety. I mean, Donald Trump, look at the two election workers, Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, whose lives were destroyed by being attacked by Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump. The judge is aware of that. Competing with that is his right to speech, political speech. But that is, you know, I think routinely exaggerated in these discussions. Mm-hmm. The First Amendment, it does not give people unlimited rights to speak about anything they want. It's balanced against other interests. And how this judge is going to effectively constrain him to protect the trial on appeal and to protect the people involved, honestly, I don't know. I think it's kind of unprecedented given Donald Trump's platform and given the sort of the tendencies even towards violence of his supporters and how fervently they support him and believe he is a victim of the judicial system.
Let's talk about the other big legal story this week, and that was the Supreme Court finally hearing oral arguments on this idea of presidential immunity. Kim, Supreme Court arguments, especially from the conservative bloc, were pretty different, and I think to a lot of people who don't follow closely, shockingly different.
It was very disheartening and disturbing, although not surprising. And I say not surprising, first of all, because they took this case. They didn't need to take this case because, just so everyone's clear, in this moment, today, as we speak, there is no such thing as criminal immunity for presidents. It's unprecedented. There's no legal support for it. There's no support in the Constitution. Actually, the text of the Constitution suggests otherwise. There's no precedent for it. So this conservative court is poised to manufacture out of thin air, the textualists, a brand new legal doctrine. Not only did they take the case, but they didn't narrow the issue to the January 6th indictment. That's really what judges should do. They rule on the case before them. They instead expanded the question presented to immunity generally, which is really more of a legislative question. They really did not want to talk about January 6th. So when you think about the fact that we're here because of January 6th, the horrors of January 6th, the excesses of January 6th, and the conservatives on the court are now poised because of that, and Jack Smith's attempt to try to disincentivize presidents from doing that in the future and hold Donald Trump accountable, they are now going to expand the powers of the presidency.
Chief Justice John Roberts really didn't say much either way throughout the hearing, and Amy Coney Barrett, another conservative of the court, seemed a lot more skeptical of all of this than that main conservative bloc. But yeah, certainly that was the tone of these oral arguments. Domenico, this is almost like, feels to me like a natural extension of the last 9 years of the establishment wing of the Republican Party wanting to look every direction but what is directly happening with their nominee and their president.
That's true. I think I would go even further back than that, though, because you have to look at the fact that people are products of their experiences. To think about the justices on the Supreme Court, I thought it was really telling. Our colleague Nina Totenberg did a really smart piece looking at the political backgrounds of each of the five justices who seem to be skeptical of not having some degree of immunity for a president from crimes. Justice Alito, Kavanaugh, Thomas, Roberts, Gorsuch all have experience either in White Houses or around Washington politics that may have lent them to this idea that there is political targeting, that they have each have their own sort of grievances with how the processes have played out, with the presidents they served with Gorsuch, his mother, and how she was investigated when she was head of the EPA. Really interesting stuff on politics, which, you know, I thought the training was that you separate out your politics from what is the, you know, dry reading of the law. But that's the thing. When a lot of this stuff is not completely spelled out, then the justices get to interpret what has happened. And it certainly, to Kim's point, not going back to any kind of originalist text and strictly looking at that. They are seeming to interpret this through their own political lens and their own experiential lens.
So we're almost certainly looking at that classic June timeline for this ruling. If the court issues a ruling that sends it back down for further questions about the difference between official and private activity, I think that's almost certainly it for this case going to trial before the election. I appreciate both of you. That's Kim Whaley of University of Baltimore, as well as Domenico Montanaro. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include the Harvard Art Museums, with Latoya M. Hobbs's It's Time, a day in the life of an artist through her monumental printmaking. Free every day, harvardartmuseums.org. And Cambridge School of Culinary Arts in Porter Square, with private cooking events for team building, family reunions, birthday parties, or nights out, cambridgeculinary.com.
WBUR occasionally offers you the opportunity to win prizes in conjunction with our fundraising efforts. A pledge is appreciated, but it is not required to win a prize. For complete rules, go to WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Worcester Polytechnic Institute, committed to transforming the future with a new master's degree in AI. Learn more at wpi.edu/AI. And the ART with Gadsby, a world premiere musical of F. Scott Fitzgerald's legendary novel, starts May 23rd. amrep.org.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Hamas has released a new video appearing to show two men kidnapped during the October 7th attack on Israel. One is an Israeli citizen. The other holds dual U.S.-Israeli citizenship. It's not clear when that video was made. The top student loan official in the Department of Education is stepping down. This is many students around the country still wait for word on their student loan packages, months behind schedule, after problems with a revamped student aid form this year. And the United Auto Workers Union says it reached a deal with Daimler Truck, averting a possible strike of more than 7,000 workers. The union got a four-year deal with pay raises covering workers at plants in North Carolina, as well as distribution centers in Atlanta and Memphis. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from The Station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Over the past week, pro-Palestinian protests across the U.S. college campuses have provoked responses from everyone from House Speaker Mike Johnson, who traveled to Columbia University this week to call for the school's president to step down, to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s.
The next day, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, responded to Netanyahu.
Mr. Netanyahu, anti-Semitism is a vile and disgusting form of bigotry, but please, do not insult the intelligence of the American people by attempting to distract us from the immoral and illegal war policies of your extremist and racist government.
Senator Sanders joins us now to talk more about this. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you, Scott.
Why do you think it was so important for you to personally respond to the Prime Minister?
Look, let's go back a bit. We all know that Hamas began this war on October 7th. End of discussion. They started the war. But in my view, and I think the view of most Americans now, Israel's response has been grossly disproportionate. And over the last 6 months, 33,000 people have been killed, 77,000 have been wounded. And right now, frighteningly, because Israel has blocked humanitarian aid, we're looking at the possibility of hundreds of thousands of people starving. So I think what Netanyahu has tried to do is deflect attention from that horrendous reality to talk about anti-Semitism, to deflect away from what he is doing.
I do have some questions about what's happening in the U.S. at this moment, because certainly we know there is data to show that anti-Semitism is on the rise, possibly highest level in years at this moment right now in the U.S. That was happening before October 7th. It's happened since. And a lot of critics are tying these intense college protests to that wave. How do you see this issue?
Look, anti-Semitism has always existed, and we're living at a time when bigotry is on the rise. But to suggest that when you have a significant majority of the American people who, among other things, do not support more U.S. military aid to Netanyahu's war machine, we're not going to suggest that all of those people are anti-Semitic. They are disgusted by what is going on in Gaza right now, which, among other things, is clearly illegal. It is breaking U.S. law. Mm-hmm. We should not be funding Netanyahu's war machine.
A lot of attention has gone to you know, almost certainly outliers, but people with racist, with anti-Semitic signs as these protests. I do want to get your response to one statement that's gotten a lot of attention from one of your colleagues, somebody you agree with on a lot. That's Pennsylvania Democratic Senator John Fetterman, who said in a post, "I fully agree with the White House. These protests are anti-Semitic, unconscionable, and dangerous. Add some tiki torches, and it's Charlottesville for these Jewish students." Curious what your response to that was.
No, I strongly disagree with Senator Fetterman. The overwhelming majority of people who are protesting, and this is not just college students. Poll after poll shows that the American people are sick and tired of funding a war machine that is doing unprecedented harm to the people in Gaza and to their entire way of life.
You're talking about trends in public opinion, and among Democratic voters, among the Democratic base, those numbers are certainly higher in terms of people who are
right,
just outraged about this war. But you're on your own in a lot of ways in criticizing the support for aid and voting against the aid. Many Democrats in Congress are certainly critical of Israel, but not as critical as you. How do you make sense of the gap between
that's
voters
a good question.
And officials?
That's a great question. But let me also say this. To my mind, the vote that took place a few days ago should never have happened. Because American law is very clear, and that is that any government that blocks U.S. humanitarian aid loses funding. But having said that, what I will tell you is that the United States Congress is way out of touch with the American people. There are already very powerful groups like AIPAC and other groups that exert enormous influence over the Congress. So you're right. Very few of us stood up and said, you know what, let's obey the law. Let's not put billions more into a military machine in Israel right now, which is causing disastrous harm to women and children there.
I don't want to take a life and death issue and boil it down to an election issue, but I'm going to ask this question because you have been very clear about what you see the stakes of this upcoming presidential election and the big concerns that you have of Donald Trump coming back into office. How concerned are you that the deep anger about this among young voters could keep Biden from winning this fall?
I am very concerned. I mean, I think not only is supporting Netanyahu's right-wing and racist government horrible policy, I think it's very bad politics, and I think you're going to see a significant part of the Democratic base very, very upset. But on the other hand, what I also believe is that given the choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, the choice is very clear, and the American people will understand that.
To bring it back to Israel, though, I know you've talked a lot to the president recently. Do you think he needs to increase the pressure? Do you think any pressure from the administration will work as long as the U.S. is still providing funding and military support to Israel?
Well, you know, I think we should do everything that we can. And in fact, there has been some improvement in humanitarian aid getting into Gaza, probably because of the president putting pressure on Netanyahu. But at the end of the day, you know, you can criticize Netanyahu on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then on Thursday, if you give him $10 billion in unfettered military aid, I think everybody knows what the story is.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks for joining us.
Take care.
And tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from several Jewish students at Columbia University who say they are experiencing anti-Semitism tied to the protests there. Emily Oster made a name for herself using data to tackle big questions about pregnancy in her book, Expecting Better. The Brown University economist sifted through study after study to help guide readers through everything from the safety of sushi to whether it's okay to garden. Oster has taken the same approach to help parents better understand the early infant and toddler years and the frantic craze of managing a household with school-age kids. But now Oster is returning to her first topic with a book especially focused on how to navigate difficult pregnancies and serious medical issues. It's called The Unexpected, Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications, co-written with Dr. Nathan Fox, who specializes in high-risk obstetrics. Emily Oster, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, early on you write, "What is different about this book is that I hope you do not have to read it. It is odd to write a book that you hope people will not read." Why did you focus on this particular topic?
In the decade or so since Expecting Better has come out, I have talked to thousands of women about pregnancy, and a lot of those conversations are about, I had this complication during pregnancy, I'm scared, I'm anxious, I want to understand it better, I want to understand what to do next time. And we did a survey of people just asking, you know, tell us about your pregnancy complications. And I think I have 4,000 responses, many of which are paragraphs and paragraphs long. That helped us with the question of where to look in the data. You know, what were the questions people had most about the data? But it also helped us think about what I think is the other value of this book, which is to help people feel a little bit less alone. A lot of these complications we don't talk about very much. And when people have them, they feel that they're the only one. And of course, they're not. Actually, about 50% of pregnancies will involve or end in one of the complications we talk about in the book.
Yeah. I want to talk about something early on that you write about that a lot of people experience. And it gets to that idea of feeling alone that you just mentioned. This is a chapter on early miscarriages and the big question of whether or not you should share that information with friends or family. And, you know, this is so much more about emotions than data, but how do you think about that? How do you approach that? And I'm wondering, has your view on when and how to share that information changed over the years?
The traditional approach to this is that you share information about pregnancy around 12 weeks. That's a point at which the risk of miscarriage is lower. You're out of the first trimester. It also happens at the point at which most people are starting to show. So it becomes more difficult to hide. Over the last several years, and people have gotten more comfortable with sharing this earlier, I don't think that it's something that you could give people advice on, because the question is really, what is the support you're going to want if you did have a miscarriage? And for some people, they aren't going to want to talk to other people, and grieving privately or with close family is what they want. For other people, that kind of broader support is going to be very valuable. The way we try to frame in the book is partly sort of thinking about the data and thinking about the risk of this by week, so people get a sense of where these rates are by week. And then we also try to help people think about, if this does happen, what's the likelihood that it will happen again? How should you process that? And what are some things you can ask your provider? So that's the approach that we hope people will take.
When you're thinking about complications and challenges that come up early on in pregnancy, how does the post-Dobbs landscape complicate all of this when you're taking a big picture view of medical care in this country?
Anytime that we restrict access to medical care around women's health, it is going to have knock-on consequences that we may not have anticipated. So in the particular case of Dobbs and these pregnancy complications, there are a number of complications, most notably second trimester miscarriage, where the care that people would get in that circumstance is very, very overlapping with the care that would be part of abortion care. And when providers have left a state or a locality because of these restrictions, that then limits the care that women can get in situations where they have lost a baby for some other reason. So it feels to me like very much just as we remove choice, we remove access, and access is something that is incredibly valuable for many, many reasons.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the other complications that you focus on in the book, some of the more common ones that a lot of people are going to be dealing with one way or another?
Yeah, so one of the more common complications is preterm birth. That's about 12% of the births in the U.S. And so there are many people who have experienced preterm birth at varying times. And we talked about in the book is kind of how much does it matter when the preterm birth is, and then is that likely to happen again, and how much correlation is there across births. There are also a lot of things which are probably more common than people expect, like vaginal trauma or prolapse, experiences that women can have after birth that are affecting how they feel, that are affecting their reproductive health, which are often not talked about because they are really about your sort of experience of the world as opposed to about mortality, which we're much better at measuring.
And, you know, this book particularly focuses on second or third, you know, even fourth pregnancies. And if you experience a complication like this the first time around, the question of whether or not to have another child can be pretty fraught. And so much of this book deals with coming up with a plan, tips on how to be your own advocate, understanding your options, even coming up with a script of how you're going to talk to a doctor about this. Why to you is that so important?
I think in order to feel engaged with your own care here, people need to have enough information to have a thoughtful conversation with their doctor. They need to have enough scripting to understand how to use the 15 minutes that they have to get the answers to the questions that are going to matter for their decisions. That's different from saying people need to be an expert. The doctor is an expert in the medical side. The person can be an expert in their own preferences and their own values. But in order for the conversation to be productive, they need to know enough to make it productive.
Do you think doctors generally appreciate a patient coming in with their own game plan like that for the conversation? Or do you think that sometimes there's a risk of putting off a doctor who sees themselves as the expert?
So I think what is hard is to come in and say, I've decided to do X. Because I think for many doctors, the answer is like, well, you're not a good candidate for that, you know, for this medical reason that I could explain to you. I think the approach of I've come in with a set of conversation topics, a set of things that I think we need to work through together, it's harder for me to see how someone would object to that. So I think there's really a balance. And this is part of why it was so valuable to write this together with Nate. So we could think about what would he want on his side from his patients and what would I want as, yes, an expert in data, but also a patient myself. How could we bring those together in a way that we would have the relationship we would both want?
I wanted to tie this back to Expecting Better. It's been more than a decade since that book came out. What is the most frustrating to you lack of change over the past decade?
We're still not doing enough research on outcomes that affect people's life but are difficult to measure. Like, how did your birth feel to you? Were you happy with it? What kind of satisfaction? How is your sex life feeling to you? Are you happy with it? We do almost none of that or very little. And it means that we're not focusing research on improving the experience that people are having in pregnancy, in birth, and then in early parenthood.
That's Emily Oster. Her new book with Dr. Nathan Fox is The Unexpected: Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you move recently, it can be stressful, but making a new home goes beyond the checklist of booking travel and packing and unpacking. Once you land in your new spot, you have to make some new friends. Experts say a big part of feeling grounded in a new place is finding your people. Janet Ojung Lee from NPR's Life Kit brings us tips on how to make yourself at home anywhere you move.
There's actually a name for that feeling of at-homeness. It's called place attachment.
Which is the fancy phrase that means feeling an emotional connection with your place.
That's Melody Warnick. She's the author of This Is Where You Belong, The Art and Science of Loving the Place You Live.
It's kind of that sensation you get when maybe you've been on vacation and you're pulling back into town and you just kind of go, this is home. This feels like home.
But before you get to this ultimate goal of place attachment, you first need to make friends.
Making friends is the ultimate challenge for adults.
And it helps to be intentional. Warnick recommends go find old friends on Instagram, join online communities, see what everyone else is up to.
Subscribe to the local newspaper or find the online events listings that will help you know what's happening in your town so that you can start to show up for things. But also, so you just kind of get a sense of where it is you landed.
Try going to an event, like joining a book club that meets once a month. You'll likely see the same people more than once, and you can all discuss the same book. And if you need a little extra help introducing yourself to new people, lean on what Warnick calls the super connectors.
The people who know everyone and they want to introduce you.
Super connectors are especially helpful for anyone who self-identifies as an introvert. And if that's you, here's more great advice from friendship coach Danielle Bayer Jackson.
The first is only say yes to the activities you know will bring you joy.
So no need to force yourself to go to that house party. Instead, you could ask to grab coffee or go to that museum you've been meaning to go anyway. Remember, you don't have to get to know everyone.
Introverts will go to a party and sit on the couch and talk to the same person for 45 minutes, but maybe leave feeling more connected than the extrovert who made it their mission to work the room. And so really being intentional is a big part of all of this, is having an objective, following through, being brave.
And if you make new lifelong friends, that's great. But don't discount the more casual relationships either. Here's author Melody Warnick again.
One way that people can do that is by creating a third place for yourself. So the idea is to find a place for yourself that isn't work and isn't home, but something totally other than that.
Whether it's your go-to coffee shop, favorite bookstore, or park for morning runs, find your comfort place in your new neighborhood. And it doesn't have to be related to your daily routine. This could also be your chance to try something completely new.
It's something that you have to be thoughtful about when you move to a new community, to just kind of open yourself up to the possibilities that are here for you, which may not be what you expect for yourself, maybe far better than you were planning.
Good luck. Janet Ujung Lee, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Good evening. Increasing clouds tonight and a chance of showers starting at 11. The Celtics play Game 3 in their playoff series against the Miami Heat today. Each team has one win under their belt. Tip-off starts in about 20 minutes. The Bruins also have a playoff game tonight. They play the Maple Leafs at the Garden at 8 p.m. The Bruins are currently up in the series 2-1. This is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
WBUR supporters include the Concord Museum. Visit What Makes History, a new exhibit exploring how the objects we choose to keep shape the stories we tell. More at ConcordMuseum.org. And Native Plant Trust's Garden in the Woods in Framingham, showcasing the beauty of New England's native plants in a dramatic, natural landscape. Information at nativeplanttrust.org. And the Umbrella Stage Company with The Full Monty, a raucous musical send-up of gender expectations that takes it all off. Through May 19th, theumbrellaarts.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The hush money criminal trial of former President Donald Trump resumes next week. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating a 35-car derailment and fire yesterday that led to evacuations and a road closure in New Mexico on the Arizona border. BNSF Railway says six of those cars were carrying propane. And campus protests against Israel's war with Hamas are spreading around the country. Some schools say many protesters aren't students or staff. This as graduation ceremonies near. The University of Southern California has canceled its main graduation ceremony scheduled for May. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at Lemelson.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. If you've ever wondered why it is so difficult to build infrastructure in this country, why these projects take so much time and cost so much money, there's a podcast that can offer some clues. It's called The Big Dig. It comes from GBH News in Boston, and it was just nominated for a Peabody Award. The podcast tells the story of a project that became infamous around the world for a price tag that went up and up and up and up.
I will be really honest with you. I made up a number. I just said, I'll give you an extra $1 billion and don't come back. We're done.
That's Jim Karasiotis. He was one of the project's many leaders.
Everybody salutes. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Everything's, you know, this is wonderful. This is good news. I made the number up. And to this day, I scratch my head and I say to myself, this is how we run the government.
I spoke with the host of the Big Dig podcast, Ian Koss, last fall, and I started off by asking him what problem the project was supposed to solve before it turned into an iconic sprawling mess.
So it begins with a highway that runs through the center of Boston. And, you know, like a lot of big cities, Boston had built this elevated highway that really divided the city in half. And it was clogged with traffic. It was ugly. It was noisy. It wasn't working well. And so in 1983, 40 years ago, Governor Michael Dukakis makes this big speech and announces that we're going to deal with this problem once and for all. We're going to take that highway and put it underground.
No one who commutes to Boston needs to be told that the Central Artery is a monumental problem. It is the cause of more individual headaches and more frazzled nerves than anything I can think of. It is dangerous. It is poorly designed. It is obsolete. It is ugly. It divides our capital city from its great and historic harbor and waterfront. So now is the time to fix the artery and fix it right.
So that's really where the story of the Big Dig begins, with this kind of moonshot visionary idea to fix a terrible highway.
Okay, so at the starting point, this makes sense, right? This is a terrible highway. Everyone wants to see it fixed. But we are now talking at a point where it became at a certain point this code word, this kind of like prime example of cost overruns and projects that never get finished. Remind us how long it actually took to complete this project. Remind us how much off track it ended up going.
Yeah. So just to give you some basic numbers, the construction itself took 16 years, right? And the cost, and these numbers are really kind of mind-blowing. I mean, the earliest estimates of the cost are in the two-ish billion-dollar range. That grows and grows and grows for many reasons. And by the time it's done, The full budget of the project is almost $15 billion. So that gives you a sense of how it got this reputation for the cost that just kept going up.
And what was the point when it went from great idea to what is going on here?
I would say that's why I wanted to do this series, was to trace that journey and make sense of that contradiction, right, between the idealism of where the project began and how troubled it ultimately became. Because, like you said, by the time this thing was in full swing, it really was the poster child of the big government boondoggle. I mean, there are congressional hearings about this when it's going on. John McCain, at one point when he was running for president, made the big dig like one of his talking points. And when you talk to the people who worked on the project, who were underground for years and years, this fact, I mean, it really haunts them, or it certainly haunted them at the time. There's a foreman I spoke to named Frank Martinez, who spent 9 years working on one piece of this project. And he told me about how much it hurt to see the reputation of the project sink. You felt like the public blamed?
The public was always finger point of anybody who worked in a big dig. I mean, we got to the point that we don't even want to wear the big dig shirts because people was always pointing at us, oh, so these are guys, they're stealing the money, you know what I mean? And us as the workers, we were just there doing the job, you know?
And so part of what I wanted to do with the series was to show how we got there, because it's complicated. And it's not as simple as, you know, there was just one corrupt politician or one single greedy contractor who came in and ruined the whole thing. I mean, the challenges and obstacles that the Big Dig faced are really systemic challenges to the way we build infrastructure in this country. And it's about kind of wonky stuff like funding and permitting and contracting and management structure. And things, like I said, that are systemic to all big projects. So if you're interested in building high-speed rail or building wind farms or tearing down highways or doing anything big and ambitious, the Big Dig really is a great case study for understanding how hard those projects are.
And of course, trillions of dollars are being spent by the federal government at this moment to do just that, though I think the Biden administration probably does not want to bring comparisons to the Big Dig at the moment. But, you know, on the other hand, it got finished. It got built. The dig was completed. There was this moment I was driving to New Hampshire for primary coverage, and I realized, like, oh my gosh, I think I'm driving on the Big Dig. Here it is. Like, I mean, has it paid off now that it is actually built, now that it is actually running and has been for quite some time? Do people in Massachusetts feel like this was ultimately worth it?
Yeah, it's complicated. And I think it depends on your point of view. There were many people I interviewed who told me that, I mean, just look at what we got. You know, it restored the heart of the city. It attracted businesses and jobs. I mean, the land around this project is some of the most valuable commercial real estate in the country. If you go to downtown Boston today, I mean, it's hard to imagine the city without this project having been done, you know, with that massive highway still running through it. So I think to a lot of people, it has totally proven itself. On the other hand, did it erase traffic in Boston? No. I mean, it's still just a big investment in road and car infrastructure. I remember talking with one local comedian who told me that really the whole point of the Big Dig was just to confuse the traffic helicopters, you know, that the TV stations run, because the traffic is still there. Mm-hmm. But now you just can't see it because it's underground.
That's a funny point. I mean, it does seem like the Big Dig looms over American infrastructure. It gets invoked as this cautionary tale, as we've been saying. Do you think that narrative is fair in the end?
I think it's simplistic, is I guess what I would say. And really my big takeaway from studying this history is that the narrative does matter, that the way we talk about a project like this, the way we tell the story, really does change how we think about our capacity to build something like this again, and also what the challenges for that building are. So I think it's really important to look at it closely and try and understand the narrative. As I was finishing up the series, I got kind of a reminder of this when I took a walk through downtown Boston with Fred Salvucci, who, if you listen to the show, he's really like the originator, the architect of the project. And he told me this story while we were walking through the city, a story that he had heard once about the Italian mystic, Saint Francis, who, like Salvucci, got his start as a builder.
God came to him in a dream and said, Francis, you have to build a church. So Francis woke up the next day and said, oh, instructions from the big guy, I have to build a church. So he began gathering stones, piling them up, digging a foundation.
Francis worked and worked, building the church all on his own. And when it was finally done, he laid down to rest. That night, there was a terrible thunderstorm. The church was struck by lightning and destroyed. But Francis once again saw God in his dream.
What's this weird joke? I do what you tell me. I work in the hot sun. I build your church, and you destroy it with an electric storm. Like, all these months of work, poof, it's all gone. And God sends to Francis, no. The church that you have to build is not a church of stones. You have to build a church in the hearts and the minds of the people. That's the only church that matters and will last.
And that's one of the questions I really try to sit with in the series, is not just what this project built in stone, but ultimately what it built in our hearts and minds.
That is Ian Koss. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can hear the whole story on the podcast, The Big Dig, from GBH News. You can find it on the NPR One app, gbhnews.org/thebigdig, or wherever you get your podcasts. The musician Sam Beam, better known by his stage name, Iron and Wine, has a new album out. It's called Light Verse.
All in good time, I gave it my best. I was alone till I found myself. Grew up to be a man, more or less. All in good time.
It's the singer-songwriter's first solo album in 7 years, and NPR's Robin Hilton is here to talk about it. Hey there.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
I'm good. Great to have you on the show. You've been listening to this album. It was just released. What stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at this very long career now that Sam Beam has had, his earliest recordings, they were pretty lo-fi, very DIY, kind of scruffy around the edges, you know, very much rooted in folk and Americana music, but more idiosyncratic. And as his music became more popular, his sound has followed a kind of typical trajectory for artists as they have more to work with, and that is his songs got bigger, more polished. But on this album, I think Sam Beam has found the sweet spot between those two sonic worlds. You know, he's still stretching. The songs are pretty expansive at times. And in fact, I would say there are moments where, this is some of the boldest work he's ever done.
I was wondering if this album would validate or surprise you based on that trajectory you were laying out, it seems like.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting, too, is that you can get this range often on a single song. Like, if you listen to the opening cut, it's called You Never Know.
Especially listening in headphones, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost like something you'd hear on Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it has this epic, almost like trippy psychedelic build. And then it lights back down to earth in this really beautiful way. And it just becomes very spare and restrained.
Was there another song that you felt like really got to the heart of what this album was about?
Yeah, I would say the sort of the centerpiece of the album is a song called Tears That Don't Matter.
Only as true to life as a lost and found, a rock and roll keychain that wish you could whistle, and tears that don't matter.
This song is, it's nearly 7 minutes long. it's a little strange and beautiful. And as you listen, it just gets more and more urgent. It just picks up speed as Sam Beam sings about how fleeting and temporary life is, you know, and how there are all these little things in our lives that we think are so important that really don't add up to that much in the end. And I'm not sure he has a clear answer for what really does matter most. It might be in the very opening line of the song when he says, open a door, hold hands. You know, just the simple idea of love and companionship and being open to the life around you.
I think a lot of us are still working for the answers to those particular questions. I mean, you mentioned a little bit about the lyrics, but I feel like so far we've been talking a lot more about the sound and the production. Iron and Wine is known for his lyricism, his imagery and storytelling. What stood out to you in the lyrics of this album?
Sam Beam's been doing this for more than 20 years now. He turns 50 this year. And on this album, Light Verse, he's very, very reflective. You know, you listen to a song like the one that he closes with, Angels Go Home.
All our morning after, sudden laughter, all our moons bloom overnight.
You know, like a lot of the lyrics in his music over the years, there's nothing too terribly on the nose in this song. But he seems to be saying, you know, in this journey called life, we are all headed, well, we're all headed essentially to the same destination. You know, the question is, what are you going to do along the way?
Like our friendly fire, naked liars, tired, pomp and circumstance.
You know, and again, I don't think he has necessarily a specific answer, but he does seem to be raising a flag here and saying, you know, take stock, ask questions. Are you present? You know, or are you distracted by all the sort of nonsense of life that sucks up all the air and all of our energy, you know, because this is it.
You mentioned that Sam Beam has been doing this for 20 years at the top. You said that there were parts of this album that surprised you based on more recent work. What do you think this album as a whole says about where he is in his career at this point in time?
Well, you know, overall, I'd say this is one of the most buoyant albums that Iron and Wine has ever made. It's very loose. And Sam Beam sounds sort of unencumbered, you know, unburdened in a way. I'm not sure that you would call this a full reset for Sam Beam, but he definitely sounds reinvigorated and certainly among the best albums he's done.
That's NPR Music's Robin Hilton. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.